Well, El Nino might bring drier than average conditions this winter. At least that's what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has reported. At least Larry Mueller here again. Thanks for joining us today. Today we'll hear more about winter weather in the months ahead. You'll also hear about climate news in our state and beyond with our guest, John Martin, one of our two weather guys. Steve Ackerman, who is retired, by the way, but claims to be on vacation. How can you be retired and you're not, you're on vacation all the time, but probably not, Steve.
I don't think with Steve. No, sir.
John's a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, certainly a faculty member there, and is going to talk about that National Climate Assessment. We can talk about gale winds. Somebody wanted to know about that. And we can talk about a guy named Increase Lapham. And, of course, we'll take your questions or maybe predictions. You think it's going to be a cold one with the plenty of snow this winter? What are you excited about for colder weather? And tell us, has there been something interesting that happened in the weather that you want to ask John about? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, we're nearing the start of winter, I guess, and I understand NOAA released its winter weather predictions.
Mm.
Do you and they forecasted for, you know, every area. What about the Great Lakes?
I think a little bit less snow than normal was one of the things that I read in that, and that is consistent with the El Nino that's brewing, and factually roaring. It's robust, and
is
that
it?
Tends to make us a little bit warmer on average in the wintertime, and it's a fairly significant signal, and that will kind of erode the chances for, you know, 50-ish plus inches of snow for the year, I think. It'll probably get a little bit less than our normal amount.
So I don't suspect that NOAA first purchases a copy of the Farmer's Almanac before they do this prediction.
Except for maybe a camping trip that some of the employees might be, you know, planning, and they need something for kindling to start the fire. But otherwise, no, for no particular informational purposes.
How
no.
do they do it?
It's a little more sophisticated than the old formula that the almanac keeps secret, as we've talked about a million times. It's a great laugh. But NOAA, it's more and more sophisticated with each passing year. Not only is the bevy of observations increasing, and we have satellite observations of different kinds that come online just about every new year. In addition to that, computer power has gotten stronger, and techniques taking advantage of that power to allow us to really make reasonably good forecasts for seasonal outlooks. Now, one has to keep in mind that a seasonal outlook is really trying to tell you what the complexion of the coming season is going to be, not what all the details are going to be. So, you know, especially for regional specific details, they are not forthcoming at our level of understanding and our level of predictability. However, knowing that the winter is going to be governed in North America by a pretty strong El Nino does tend to have regional signals that are repeatable. When we have one of these strong El Ninos, it tends to be wet in the southeast. It tends to be a little bit wetter rather than snowy here in the Midwest. And so those are things that we can kind of, with a reasonable expectation, put out there as seasonal forecasts. And so, you know, I like big winter and big snow, but I have a feeling this year will be one of those years that won't be quite memorable in my book.
Yeah, it's not going to tell you if it's going to snow on January 5th, but
no.
But overall, you can expect.
Yeah, you know, when you know you get 50 inches of snow, as we do here in Madison in an average year, the chances in a strong El Nino year like the one we're entering now of us getting over 50 inches of snow is slim. It's not zero because nature has got lots of variability in it, but it's slim. And so, you know, if you were a betting person, and I never bet on the weather, but if I did, I would probably be saying, yeah, I'm going to be thinking about something in the 40 to 50 range instead of 50 plus.
Yeah. And I can't imagine how we, and I probably shouldn't say this, probably they'll be able to figure it out, but I can't imagine how we would ever be in a position where we could say it's going to rain on 2 months from now.
Yeah, it's, I can't imagine it either, Larry. The fact that the weather forecast for the next day or 2 days from here is based on the initial conditions, the observations around the globe today, and the fact that you can't make a reasonable prediction about what those observations will look like even a week in advance over such a wide area, means that you're prohibited from ever having sufficiently accurate initial conditions to make a forecast that far in advance that's point specific. And so then the follow-up question is, do we even need that? The value of a forecast 15 or 20 days in advance for almost every interest that you can imagine is pretty small. It's not true for every interest. There might be some interests where it really does matter. But the vast majority of them, it doesn't matter that you don't know more than 5 or 6 or 7 days in advance.
Yeah. Farmers might like to know.
Yeah, they would like to know.
But, you know, there's some things that, you know, maybe we're better off not knowing.
Well, yeah, and I mean, even with the example of the farmers, I suspect that what matters to them and their bottom line at the end of the year is what the season delivers and the manner in which it delivers it, so that you don't get all your rain in 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a disaster. And if you knew that was coming, what could you do about it? Probably not much, you know?
Not a heck of a lot.
Yeah, it's tricky.
The National Climate Assessment recently came out, and it's released every 4 years by the U.S. Global Change Research Program. What are the key findings on that?
I think that some of the key findings are that many places in the contiguous United States are having really substantial temperature increases measured over the course of a year. I think I read somewhere that a lot of places have had temperature increases of as much as 5 degrees Fahrenheit on average in the last 10 years compared to the prior 30. And so the rate at which some of the manifestations of the slow march upward of global average temperatures is starting to get alarming. It's picking up in places where, you know, it's starting to have impacts and people are noticing. So I think that, to me, that's the most dire aspect of the most recent climate assessment. And that's pretty much what they're putting in the headlines. This thing's coming faster than we've been expecting.
Yeah. So maybe an example of some kind, what kinds of weather events that we're experiencing now that result from this?
One thing that a colleague of mine and I are involved in a big project, proposal writing project right now, we have this suspicion that the overlap between severe weather season, which has traditionally been spring, you know, late March into June or July for us here in the northern Great Lakes states, and the winter weather, which traditionally ends somewhere in the mid-March period, is going to start to overlap a little bit more. And so that the threats and the impacts that can be delivered by fairly substantial precipitation or severe weather in the midst of the end of the winter is going to become something that certain people in the United States have to contend with year to year, and we haven't had ever to do that, really. And so this is one of the ways that a systematic warming of the planet tends to alter regional weather patterns and even regional climate expectations in ways that I think can have pretty big impacts. And so we have a strong suspicion that's already happening, and we're trying to get some funding to actually put some people to work at investigating that question and various other questions related to it.
The growing season has changed. I mean, just got a new report, and we're actually going to do a show on this down the road a bit, not too far anyway, about the growing regions.
Yeah, is it more than half of the United States has had an increase in its hottiness zone of a half a category, which really means a lot, and especially when you think the southern states are relatively immune from any changes in that. It's warm there in mid-February, has always been warm in mid-February, so they're not getting any changes. It's everywhere sort of north of, I don't know, southern Missouri, where you're starting to see these rather dramatic half-category, some places full-category changes, and the hottiness zone assessments are being made on a much higher resolution grid, so you're kind of really getting into valleys and adjacent hillsides and so on in locales. So I think there's almost 4 times as much data in the most recent one, and so it's reflecting some really big changes around much of the country, a large part of the real estate of the contiguous states.
So let's focus on the Great Lakes for a minute. How has the average winter temperature in our area changed over the last 4 years?
4 years or maybe more, decades. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think on average, we're probably
40
seeing,
years.
On average, probably something on the order of 3 degrees Fahrenheit would be an average. And there'll be some locations where it'd be greater than that. And that's, you know, when you think about that, think of all the days in the wintertime where the high temperature is 32 or higher, or 35 or higher, and then, or 32 and higher, and then add 3 degrees to that. That means all those days that were on the border between rain and snow become complete rain events. And that changes everything about the way you look at the winter in certain places. I'd say northern Illinois. Rockford's probably one of those places. Beloit's probably one of those places. Milwaukee may be one of those places. So pretty dramatic change.
Dean in Colorado will give you a chance. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Good morning. I was wondering, one of the topics that I read recently was that AI may be used to forecast weather, but it seems to me that's more of has statistics on its side. And the models that you were talking about have more prognostic based in physics, and that under a changing climate that would be favored as opposed to AI, because AI would be more apt to use historical information.
That's partly true, but the other power of artificial intelligence is the ability to mine any kind of data set, whether it's an actual empirical observation or the output from a numerical forecast model. And which is, as you said, using the physical laws of the what governs the atmosphere, and trying our best to make reasonable approximations to those mathematical expressions that we can program into the computer. And we've done a tremendous amount of good work in that field in the last 50 years. It's a revolution, a silent revolution. What the AI capacities promise is the ability to go through, let's say we run, instead of one forecast simulation for tomorrow's weather or the day after, let's run 1,000 simulations where we just make little, almost imperceptible alterations to the initial conditions at the beginning of that forecast run, and then we'll have 1,000 possible outcomes, maybe 10,000 possible outcomes. We can set AI onto that 10,000 data set output and start mining it for different types of relationships. They would be statistical, that's correct, but they might also give us insight about what's the most likely result at 18 hours for Rockford, Illinois, out of that giant pile of output. And so that's the kind of thing that we can try to tame and try to use to our advantage in the modern era with artificial intelligence. I don't think, though, that it's going to fundamentally change the way that we assess the potential accuracy of some of these simulations that we run. That's going to still require expert judgment, but there's going to be an interesting overlap, and I'm confident that we'll make really nice strides that way.
We'll talk some more about that and many other things as well. Peter from Eden emailed us a really cool photo about a very cloudy day, and we'll get to that as well. I know John's going to have an answer for Peter's question, and he'll have one for yours too. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org with your question and or photo. We'll take a quick look at the news, then we'll be back with John. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. We're getting a weather and climate update on the program today. It's got to be the last Monday of the month because that means our weather guys come by. I'm Larry Mueller. John Martin with us, one of our two weather guys. Steve Ackerman's on vacation. John's a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we talk weather and climate. What's going on with the weather in your neck of the woods? Share your general questions about weather and maybe the field of meteorology in general. You can call us. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And John, we had a chance to look at a photo, and let me read the email that Peter sent us from Eden, with Minnesota.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know.
On a very cloudy day earlier this month, he observed a really colorful opening in the sky. And is this venting warmer air trapped under the cloud cover or something else? He's wondering, it looks like a kind of a ball.
Yeah.
A cloud ball coming out of an overall cloud.
Yeah, I saw the picture. It's a great picture. It's never boring to see these, and you see them a lot near airports. Not exclusively, but a lot near airports. And so I think what was going on there was, from what I see in the photograph, there's a low-level stratocumulus deck. Stratocumulus are clouds that are quite low. They don't have a deep convective turret structure. They're kind of flat. And they're usually composed of supercooled liquid water droplets. And that means they're droplets of liquid water that have temperatures below 0 degrees Celsius. And they are susceptible then to turning into ice at the slightest sort of provocation. One of those provocations is the exhaust from jet engines. And that exhaust has chemicals in it that has some of the chemicals have a certain structure that mimics the presence of ice. It looks like an ice lattice. And it can actually instigate the formation of ice in these stratocumulus supercooled water droplets. And so this is a phenomenon known as aircraft-produced ice particles, APIPs. And one of my very good friends, Art Ragnow, who's now in Tucson, Arizona, retired, was at the University of Washington as a cloud physicist. It was in over 400 cloud flights trying to understand ice in clouds. And this was one of the things that he discovered, is that the propellant from jet aircraft can actually seed clouds. And so what you see in the photograph is a giant hole. It's like somebody put a footprint, like a snowshoe footprint, on the top of the cloud. And then underneath that hole, you can see filamentary cloudiness. It actually is falling snowflakes coming through in the place where the cloud was seeded by the penetration of the aircraft.
So where it flew through.
That's right. Where it flew through, it left a trail of chemicals that initiated the ice production, just in the little puncture that it made in the cloud. And so then all of that ice starts to fall as little snowflakes, and it looks sort of like mare's tails falling out of the hole in the cloud. So it's spectacular.
It is indeed a spectacular photo, for sure. Wish we could put that up on our page. Maybe we could. Peter in Stoughton will give you a chance. Hi, Peter.
Hello there. I was wondering if you could tell me the difference between the European model of forecasting and the ones that we use in North America.
Yeah, that's a good question. There are the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting is in what used to be in Bracknell, England, and now it's somewhere south of London still, or west of London. And it's the center for the Europeans conglomeration of scientists who have spent, you know, the last 50 or so years learning how to make numerical weather prediction models and also then forecasting the weather with them. Companion activities and enterprises have been going on in the United States since about the same time, since the mid-1950s. And so we've developed our own suite of numerical forecast models and the processing of data, which is by which we ingest or feed those models the initial conditions. One of the big differences, but not the only difference, between the European Center's enterprise and the one in the United States is how that data is assimilated. One of my colleagues now is... he's on leave at the university, and he's the assistant director at NOAA, National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration, for data and prediction, and Professor Michael Morgan. And what he's trying to do is force NOAA to finally adopt much more modern data assimilation, it's called, techniques, which take all that data, assimilate it in a beautiful way, in a consistent way, mathematically and physically, and then allow it into the forecast models. He tells me that when we take the European data, the European Center's assimilated data, and put it into our global forecast system, GFS model here in the United States, the GFS model consistently outperforms the European Center model. The advantage they have is that they're doing a better job somehow, and he's trying to figure this out on behalf of NOAA and citizens of the United States. He's trying to figure out why is the European Center assimilation system consistently better than what we're doing here in the United States. And once they figure it out, they're going to implement a better system here, and we're going to hear a lot different sort of arguments about which model is better. I think those days are right around the corner, so it's pretty exciting.
Well, That is pretty cool. But, I mean, we're pretty good. I mean, are they ahead of us or something?
No. See, I mean, this is the thing that's kind of funny about it, is that you hear about this. And it's popularized because there's so much interest in the weather. And so not only, I think, local broadcasts, but certainly institutes like the Weather Channel make it clear that there are things at 7 and 8 days out in the forecast in which the forecast models differ rather substantially. And sometimes you can have a single forecast model, the global forecast system, the GFS here in the United States, that will change its tune about day seven from day to day as you approach day seven. That's normal. That's quite normal. But they like it, especially when they can say head-to-head, the European Center against the GFS, it looks like the big snowstorm is not in the GFS, but it's in the European Center. And then days later, the snowstorm verifies, and everybody on the East Coast says, boy, the European model is better than the American model. And really, we're talking about something at 7 and 8 days. We're not talking about tomorrow's forecast or even 3 days from now's forecast. And even then, when it is a forecast triumph, let's say, for the ECMWF, it's not going to be something systematic that where they always do better. It's just, you know, one of those things. If you're flying to Detroit out of, you know, JFK and you get snowed in, you're going to remember that day and you're going to say, damn, that GFS is not any good. And it's not really a fair thing to do.
Oh, man. Peter, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234. You can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ray in West Bend emailed us, what's the relationship between dew point and relative humidity? Is there a formula?
It's not a straightforward formula, no. It's something that you can determine from a fairly complicated chart that isn't that hard to use, but it's hard to create. The dew point is the temperature at which the water vapor that's in the air will start to condense onto objects. So you cool the air at constant pressure to that point, and whatever the amount of water vapor is that happens to constitute that air mass will start to condense. That is a measure of humidity, in a sense. On 2 days, let's say, the dew point is 60 degrees on one day and the dew point is 66 degrees on another day. It's very obvious that the day where the dew point is 66 must have more water vapor in it, so it's a more humid day. But the relative humidity depends on what the actual air temperature is. So you could have the perplexing situation in which the day with a higher dew point actually has a lower relative humidity because the air temperature would be so much higher, perhaps, on that day. So there's not really a one-to-one correspondence between dew point and relative humidity. For my money, I care more about the dew point temperature because I think all of us have our own built-in standards. And, of course, since I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time, I have it built into my head that when the dew point gets to 60 degrees, I notice it, and it's uncomfortable. For me, it starts to be a little bit too muggy. And when it's 70 or above, it's wildly uncomfortable for me. Other people may have a different standard. But I never use the relative humidity to make that assessment because it's so dependent on the air temperature, which can be so variable from one day to the next that it masks all of the humidity characteristics.
That is a very good explanation. Hmm. Thank you for that, and thanks for that question. Teresa emailed us. They had a really warm weather in Green Bay right before Halloween, and then the temperatures dropped very quickly. Oh, she caught a... She has a photo here. She caught the temperatures dropped really quickly, and she caught this photo. A day later, about 9:30 in the morning, it was amazing. She looked it up, so it's so she's schooled on how and what caused it. One of the coolest things was, she's seen in the sky with her sunglasses on. The halo had the rainbow spectrum colors in it. So it's a halo around the sun. Mm. And then so right around the sun, it's very, there's a kind of a bright yellow halo. And then quite a ways out, there's a huge circle around the sun.
Oh, yeah, very interesting. Probably high-level cirrus clouds, which could or could not have been, you know, they're not necessarily going to come along with the weather changes at the surface that she described, that is warm on Halloween and then pretty chilly the next day afterwards. You could have cirrus clouds come in when the temperature does just the opposite, goes from being cold to relatively warming up. But the cirrus clouds have such tiny little shards of ice in them, little ice particles, and probably cold enough temperatures that they're almost disc-like, because ice can form in a lot of different ways. And I think the one that does the refraction, which creates the halo, the best are these little discs of ice that form at about minus 25-ish degrees Celsius. So that's probably it. And it's a thin little gossamer whisper of the cirrus clouds, which is more than enough, with the sun being so bright as it is, to produce that refractive halo around it. Very interesting.
I've neglected to tell you that there were a very thin cloud of cirrus clouds.
There you go. There you go. Part of the prescription.
Failed to make that comment, so I'm glad that you were able to figure it out without knowing about
it. Yeah, that's what they call independent confirmation, right?
Oh, Robert emailed us. He's been a mailman for over 30 years, and today he's seeing the sandhill cranes leaving his circle, he says, in large flocks, climbing up to the jet stream when they're gone. Every year, for him, that signals the start of the winter, when the sandhill cranes climb up to that jet stream and take off.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. I have another way that's exactly consistent. November 23rd is the first day in the calendar year after September 1, at which Madison has, at least in its historical record, a temperature at zero or below Fahrenheit. So that's the beginning of winter for me. Whenever that threshold is met, it's arbitrary, but whenever that threshold is met, that's the beginning of winter. And son of a gun, we have a couple of days after that, we get our first quarter of inch of snow. So it's pretty darn good.
I got about an inch
Did
and
you?
A half.
Yeah, you must have done
almost.
Better than it. We only got about a half at my house overall.
I had to get the snow shovel out.
Ah, rats. I wish you'd done better than we did.
Well, I mentioned that we'd talk about gale for a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Gales. You recently wrote an article about gale winds. So what's a gale wind and where do they occur in our area?
I think a gale force wind is a wind of 30 or 35 miles per hour or greater. I can't remember if I'm right about that. Sometimes it's the translation between knots, nautical miles per hour, and miles per hour. But it's in the 30 to 35 range. And that is a wind that can do some structural damage. I forget now what the criteria was, because when I grew up on the East Coast, that was a substantial warning. You know, your gale force warnings are in effect, and you'd pay attention if you had some sort of a sea craft or you were out on the ocean. But I didn't, so I don't know what it actually means, but it's probably not good. It's certainly strong winds, the kind that'll take little branches off of trees and so on when you're away from the ocean. So that's a sort of a threshold of really substantial winds. Everyone's going to complain about a windy day with a gale wind. That's from the old Beaufort scale from the late 19th century that was kind of a wind warning for mariners. And came with a whole bunch of different coded flags and so on that you'd post at the coast so people would know what to expect.
So what causes it?
Strong pressure gradient. The only thing that causes the wind in any instance at all is a strong horizontal difference between the pressure at one location and an adjacent one. Whenever that difference is big, the winds are going to be strong. Whenever it's weak, the winds will be weak. And so that is really the whole ball of wax for what causes the winds. Now, that's the broadest answer. Moving cyclones and anticyclones, the disturbances in the atmosphere that bring us either clear skies for anticyclones or cloudy precipitation with cyclones, they have their own pressure fields around them. And so when they're moving, the pressure gradient, the difference in pressure, is also a moving target. So you can go from part of a day where you're in a region where the gradient's fairly weak and the winds are not strong, to as the storm moves past you, you move into a portion of the storm where the gradient's quite large and suddenly the winds pick up. So that's how you get your day-to-day variation in the winds, by the motion of these weather systems.
And we've had some famous ones, of course, the Armistice Day storm and the Edmund Fitzgerald.
November 10th, 1975, brutal storm developed over the Central Plains and hooked northeastward across Lake Michigan into Lake Superior, and the pressure dropped dramatically during the late part of the day. And so that's the pressure at the center of the storm. I think it got down into the low 970 millibar range, which is about 3 or 4% below standard sea level pressure. It doesn't sound like much, but that's a Category 2 or 3 hurricane. So the atmosphere doesn't permit very much departure from average, but when it gets, 30 or 40 millibars below average, it's really remarkable. And that storm made its way across Lake Superior, and the ship itself found itself on the southwest edge of the storm at the wrong time, and that's where traditionally the pressure gradient can be the strongest.
Oh.
And they had, what did they have, 40 or 50 foot waves or something on Lake Superior, and opened up, they think, the covers for some of the iron ore canisters, and that's what sunk the ship.
Yeah, it was. And we'll never forget that one as long as we can remember Gordon Lightfoot's song.
Yeah, that was pretty desperate.
Absolutely. Well, the other thing I wanted to be sure to talk about was Increase Lapham. Earlier this month, the National Weather Service celebrated its 153rd anniversary, and we had one Wisconsin professor who helped with the sciences, the services establishment.
Yeah, he did. Increase Lapham was a naturalist. He knew a lot about a whole bunch of different things in the natural sciences. One of his big interests was meteorology. And I forget now who the congressman representing Milwaukee was, but it was somebody who he knew, and he had been petitioning this person. This congressperson was also a Civil War vet. And he was petitioning him, hey, we should establish a national observation network for weather. This is too important to leave to chance. And President Grant was in office at the time, and Grant, of course, realized how important it was to know about the weather as a military general. And so anyway, the combination of Lapham and the congressman from Milwaukee was enough to get a bill to pass through the House of Representatives and then through the Senate that established the Army Signal Service. And Grant signed it February 9th, 1870. And that was the establishment of the National Weather Service. So it was going to establish a network of observation sites, mandated to send those observations, I think, 8 times a day, every 3 hours, around the country to a central location, telegraph office in Washington, D.C. And the first the Weather Service actually began its day-to-day operations on the 1st of November, 1870, and then a week later, Lapham made the first forecast that likely saved lives and property on the Great Lakes, November 8th, 1870.
Wow.
Pretty awesome, huh? And it's all Wisconsin.
That is very, very cool. So, you know, today, what's it like today? What does the National Weather Service do today?
What a huge job they have, and they do such an excellent job at it. So they're still required to collect observations. There's now, of course, what's gone on beyond that is now there's an expectation of making forecasts for regional locations. So the Milwaukee County warning area is about the bottom third, let's say, of the state of Wisconsin and the lakes in that region. And the Milwaukee office has a responsibility for site-specific forecasts for those communities trying to save life and property, and the same on the water. They do not have the responsibility to tell a factory that might store some of its equipment or products outside that there's a thunderstorm bearing down on them. They don't have that responsibility. And so a lot of private firms come in and fill that gap using Weather Service and taxpayer-funded observations and information. But the Weather Service has, I don't know if I know how many stations it has, forecast offices, but it's something on the order of 100 across the United States, its territories, and adjacent waters. And it employs thousands of people, top scientists. Some of them do research. The largest fraction do forecasting and public relations about forecasting and high-impact stuff. So they do an excellent job.
They do indeed. Another email, I don't have a name for it. I've always wondered what brought John here from the East Coast.
I loved living in the Eastern United States because when I grew up there, I got to see the really big snows that occur in that part of the country routinely. And if I'd grown up in another decade, I might not have seen it so routinely. It was just perfect. 1970s were perfect for that. So I had a lifelong interest in winter weather. And then I went to graduate school and undergrad at different places where it didn't snow very much, St. Louis and Seattle. And then when I was done with my graduate work and had a postdoctoral opportunity and I knew I wanted to be a professor, I thought, I want to come to a place where it snows. And that was really all I had in mind. But then when I got a chance to apply for this job, which was now sort of 31 years ago this last fall, and I learned about how great the University of Wisconsin-Madison is, and I didn't know anything about that from a distance. But boy, oh boy, when you have a chance to come to a place like this and contribute to scholarship in an exciting field, and you don't take it, you're an idiot. And I'm not an idiot. I may be stupid, Larry, but I'm not an idiot. So it was a great opportunity, and I've loved every minute of it. It's a great place to be.
31 years. Oh, my goodness. John, it's... And for many of those years, you've been right here.
Yeah, more than 26 of them. Yep, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is indeed. John Martin, our guest, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, one of our two weather guys. Steve Ackerman, he'll probably be back next month. And
yep, no more vacations.
No more vacation for that retired guy. Oh, man. Great to have John with us, and they'll be back the last Monday of the month. Tomorrow, it's a pet care day. We'll talk about that respiratory virus that's showing up in some dogs. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.